Well, good morning. We're going to resume Deuteronomy chapter 11. So let's go ahead and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 11. It's been a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, since we put a period to chapter 10. And so now I would like to resume our consideration of the book of Daniel. Excuse me, the book of Deuteronomy. This morning's lesson is entitled, Do, comma, and be blessed. Do, comma, and be blessed. I'm going to read the first 21 verses of Deuteronomy 11. Now, as I read this, and those of you that may listen on the church website, pay close attention to words which denote conditions, requirements, words that denote duty or a response on the part of Israel to their God. And then see also, as I read this, that you can also identify the reasons for Israel's responses. So we're going to see what God expected Israel to do. And then I want you to pay close attention to the reasonings behind all of their doing. Why did God require them to do this? What was the motivator behind their positive responses to God Almighty? Therefore, thou shalt love the Lord thy God and keep his charge and his statutes and his judgment and his commandments always. Know ye this day, for I speak not with your children which have not known, and which have not seen the chastisement of the Lord your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and stretched out arm. Notice carefully what verse 2 is implying. And his miracles and his acts, which he did in the midst of Egypt unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and unto all his land. And what he did unto the army of Egypt, unto their horses and to their chariots, how he made the water of the Red Sea to overflow them as they pursued after you, and how the Lord hath destroyed them unto this day. Now, beloved, again, we're talking 40 years after these events. What he did unto you in the wilderness, until ye came unto this place, and what he did unto Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the sons of Reuben, how the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their household, and their tents, and all their substance that was in their possession in the midst of all Israel. But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Lord which he did. Now look at verse 7 and then look at verse 2. What is Moses saying about this second generation of Israelites? They were not born in a vacuum, were they? They were born and eyewitnesses, underline that in your mind, eyewitnesses of these mighty events and acts of God. Therefore, now look at verse 8, therefore, look at verse 1, therefore. And you always know that you got to read everything that comes before the therefore to find out why that therefore is there. So up until verses 7, Moses here is reiterating historical events, which we'll touch upon here in a few moments, which this second generation of Israelites were eyewitnesses, heard, saw, felt, and felt the impact of what they saw. Therefore ye shall keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that ye may be strong and go in and possess the land, whether ye go to possess it. Now notice here in verses 18, What is the result of this obedience? What is the result of their positive response? Notice that ye may be strong and go in and possess the land with the ye go to possess it. And notice, beloved, nothing is mentioned here of being saved. We're not talking about justifying grace here. We're not talking about justification by faith alone through Christ alone and through the finished work of Christ alone. We're talking about earthly, tangible, and carnal blessings. Another word I can use is the word prosperity. Prosperity. Physical, earthly, tangible prosperity would fall upon the nation if they did what is found in verse 8. Keep all the commandments. And that ye may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers, to give unto them and to their seed a land that floweth with milk and honey. Now look at verse 9 again. Notice that their responses to God in keeping all the commandments was a prerequisite for the nation remaining in the land and enjoying the physical, earthly, tangible bounties of that land. Verse 9 has no reference to salvation. Salvation's not even on the radar screen. For the land whither thou goest in possess it is not as the land of Egypt, from whence ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest it with thy foot, as a garden of herbs. But the land whither ye go to possess is a land of hills and valleys, drinking it water of the rains of heaven. Notice in verses 8 the description of the land. Nothing here is referring to any allegorical or spiritual interpretation that's needed. We're talking about a physical, tangible, carnal parcels of land that have been blessed. A land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it from the beginning of the year unto the end of the year. Now notice that blessing. It would be like saying from January 1st to December 31st, God watches and cares for this land from the very first day of the calendar year to the last day of the calendar year. And it shall come to pass, if ye shall hearken diligently, now notice verses 13, unto what? My commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God, to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. That sounds like Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5. I will give you salvation. No. I will give you the rain of your land in his due season, the first rain and the latter rain, that thou mayest gather in thy corn, in thy wine, in thy oil. Beloved, have we even touched upon salvation? No. But it is quite evident that the physical, tangible, carnal, earthly blessings and prosperity of this nation in respects to her land was predicated and conditioned upon them keeping God's commandments, God's statutes, God's judgments, and his charge. Look now, go back to verse 1. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and notice, keep his charge, keep his statutes, keep his judgments, and to keep his commandments, not just on the Sabbath, but always. And yet, beloved, nothing here at all about being saved. Everything had to do with Israel's attachment to their land and whether or not God would bring the rain cycles at the appointed time, blessing their fields, right? Blessing their harvest, blessing their livestock, right? Blessing the minerals that would be found in the very hills and mountains of the land. Read on. And I will send grass in thy fields for thy cattle, verse 15, that thou mayest eat and be full. Nothing to do with going to heaven. Take heed to yourself. Now look at verse 16. Here's now something's brought into the play. Take heed now, that your heart be not deceived, and ye turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the Lord's wrath be kindled against you, and he shall shut up the heaven, and there be what? No rain, and that the land yield not her fruit, lest ye perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord giveth you. Now notice verses 16, as you and I read the rest of the Old Testament, when you go through the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, and you read the prophets of the Old Testament, you will find out that Israel, unfortunately, look at verse 16, they unfortunately did not take heed. Did they? They didn't take heed to the admonishment of verse 16. And then notice the consequences of verse 17. How many times do you read in Israel's ancient history in the Old Testament of God sending famines, God sending pestilence that devour their potential harvest? And then we haven't mentioned it here yet, but what about the uncircumcised Gentile pagan armies that would invade her land and take what was left of the harvest? Read on. Therefore, okay, we got another therefore here, verse 18. Therefore shall ye lay up these my words in your heart and in your soul, bind them for a sign upon your hand. Now this has a very close or a parallel relationship to Revelation 13 and the so-called mark of the beast. They were to bind these admonishments for a sign upon the hand, that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. What do you find in the human body between your eyes? Your mind. Your forehead between your two eyes. Isn't it amazing that the imagery, I'm just going to touch on this now and maybe touch on it again, but notice in verses 18 how this parallels the so-called mark of the beast that you hear so much about, with everybody being implanted with microchips and satellites monitoring your every move and Big Brother monitoring every one of your shopping transactions. So ludicrous, so foolish, and so blasphemous in interpretation. Such poor handling of God's precious words. I think here in verses 18 is where you see, or I believe John borrows that imagery in Revelation 13. Beloved, the mark of the beast in the forehead and the mark of the beast within someone's hand or in their forearm has nothing to do with receiving a microchip, but has everything to do in a spiritual concept of man's mind, what you know and what you believe and how you feel, in relationship with his hand, that is a picture of your actions or your deeds, whether they be good or whether they be evil. Notice, they were to bind these requirements in their mind or in their heart. And the hand refers to what? Their response, their obedience, in this case, is being encouraged. Their obedience is being called upon, but in the end, as a people, what did we see? In the end, their hands only rendered disobedience, because in their heart and mind, they didn't take heed to what Moses is giving, just in Deuteronomy 11 alone, let alone the other four books of Moses. Let's read on. Quite a lengthy text. And ye shall teach them your children, speaking of them when thou sittest in thy house, and when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Beloved, I believe you find this elsewhere in the book of Deuteronomy, don't you? You find this much, much earlier. And notice when you look at that verses, in that verses 19, look, it says, where you sit, where you walk, where you lie down, and when you get up. Isn't that amazing that it covers the whole spectrum of a 24-hour day? So if I'm addressing myself to any parents here this morning that may be listening, verses 19, number 1, teaches that the public school is not the replacement of your responsibility to your children to teach them the ways of God. Public school is not going to do it. Bible college, many of which ain't going to do it. You don't want the street smarts of this world to be teaching your children how to live and what to do and how to respond. You, mom and dad, have a responsibility based on verses 9 that you are to be the primary influencer in your children's life. Not the gang on the street. Not the bozos on TV or on the movie screen. And not the public school system. Matter of fact, in many instances, the public school system is 180 degrees against the parent and some of the shenanigans that they bring into the public school system, as we see today. And thou shalt write them upon the doorpost of thy house and upon thy gates, that your days may be multiplied. Look at verse 21 as I close out my text. That your days may be multiplied in the days of your children in the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers to give them as the days of heaven upon earth. Salvation not mentioned. But earthly prosperity is. Well, we concluded Deuteronomy chapter 10. When I look back at our notes, we actually concluded chapter 10 by considering the first 12 verses of chapter 11. We know that chapter divisions and verse numberings are very helpful. it kind of helps us to find things in the Bible, and that's good. But there are times and places where a chapter division can do more harm than it does good. And that's because sometimes when you end one chapter, you start another chapter. Sometimes what you thought was the ending of chapter such and such, you find a continuation in the next chapter. And so you got to be careful. That's why in chapter 11, verses 1, it says, therefore. Therefore. So then you have to go back and read the closing portion, if not all, of chapter 10 of Deuteronomy to get the thrust behind that call or that admonishment for the word, therefore. So we concluded Deuteronomy 10 by considering Deuteronomy 11, 1-12 in our where we left off in our consideration, where Moses relates several historical events witnessed by those in the nation. And we're talking primarily of this second generation of Israelites that were born, grown up, getting old, at least some of them 40 to 60 years old by now. This second generation of Israelites wandering there in the wilderness because of their disobedience at the southern tip of Kadesh Barnea, where it took them 40 days to reach that spot from leaving Egypt. And they were told to go into the land. The spies came back with a real negative, exaggerated, embellished report, except for Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua said, "Trust God, let's go." The other 10, unfortunately, persuaded the nation not to go. And that led to a judgment. It took them 40 days to get there. God, in turn, said, fine, you're going to wander for 40 years as a judgment to that unbelief. Okay, so he's talking to the second generation of Israelites. Now, notice that verse 2. Let's look at that verse 2. And know ye this day. Key word, know. Moses here is not banking on ignorance, superstition, legend, myth, hearsay. I want you to know this day, for I speak not with your children, notice, which have not known, and which have not seen the chastisement of the Lord your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his stretched out arm. Look at verse 7. But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Lord which he did. Notice verses 2 and verses 7. Moses right up front reminds the entire nation what I'm about to tell you, you already know. You can't claim ignorance. You can't claim the Fifth Amendment. You can't claim, oop, I just didn't know. No one told me, or I didn't see. They can't claim that. Notice in verses 3, he mentions things like the battle between Moses and Pharaoh in the first at least 12 chapters of the book of Exodus, leading up to his confrontation with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Notice verses 4. He mentions the crossing of the Red Sea and the fact that the entire army of Pharaoh was completely destroyed there at the Red Sea. Verses 5 to 7, we see the wicked were destroyed there in verses 5. And what he did unto you in the wilderness until ye came unto this place, and what he did unto Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, the sons of Reuben, how the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and that their household and their tents and all their substance that was in their possession in the midst of Israel. So notice he is reiterating key points in Israel's history, showing God's divine intervention on behalf of the nation because of God's covenant relationship with this nation, with their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Are you following along? Verses 2, verses 7, very important. Telling the nation, you know these things, you saw these things, and you heard these things. Now, allow me to read from a book entitled Notes on the Pentateuch, Genesis to Deuteronomy, this one volume, just the first five books of Moses, by C.H. McIntosh. It's a good, easy, soothing, devotional read. Listen to the words in respect to Moses reiterating historical things from the past. Moses felt it to be of the very highest importance that all the mighty acts of Jehovah should be kept prominently before the hearts of the people and deeply engraved on the tables of their memory. The poor human mind is vagrant and the heart volatile. And notwithstanding all that Israel had seen of the solemn judgments of God upon Egypt and upon Pharaoh, they were in danger of forgetting them and losing the impression which they were designed and eminently fitted to make upon them. Here Edesheim is saying, the mind's fickled. The mind is, McIntosh, the mind is fickled. We only remember what we want to remember. And sometimes as we get older, our memory gets fuzzy, it gets hazy, it gets foggy. And here what McIntosh here is saying is, Moses wants this to be literally engraved, chiseled into their heart and soul as a nation, in the very psyche of the nation. He wants this to be etched like with a diamond pen, never to be forgotten. He continues, it may well feel disposed to wonder how Israel could ever forget the impressive scenes of their history in Egypt from the first to last. The descent of their fathers thither as a mere handful, their steady growth and progression as a people, spite of formidable difficulties and hindrances, so that from the insignificant few, they had become by the good hand of their God upon them as the stars of heaven from multitude. Now, beloved, if you're listening to me and those who are here listening, back up to verse 22 of chapter 10, just before the word therefore in chapter 11, verse 1. Thy fathers went down into Egypt with 70 persons. That's what McIntosh here alludes to, okay? And how the Lord thy God had made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude. I like to put a challenge to my premillennial dispensational brethren. Those of you who claim that the Palestinian covenant was never realized and that the Abrahamic covenant still needs to be fulfilled. One of those prophecies given by God to Abraham that one day his own seed, his natural seed, would become as the stars of heaven. Well, how do you interpret verse 22 then? God had made thee as the stars of heaven for multitude. And that was said and written by Moses some 40 years after they left the land of Egypt. I believe that part of the Abrahamic covenant was fulfilled. How do you handle that? Why do you contend that that covenantal blessing still yet needs to be fulfilled when here it says they were as the stars of heaven? Let me continue on. Nor was it merely that Jehovah had done to Egypt and to Pharaoh that the people were called to remember, but also what he had done amongst themselves. How soul subduing the judgment upon Dathan and Abiram and their households. How awful the thought of the earth opening her mouth and swallowing them up. And for what? For their rebellion against the divine appointment. In the history given in Numbers, Korah the Levite is the prominent character, but here he is omitted, and the two Reubenites are named, two members of the congregation, because Moses is seeking to act on the whole body of the people by setting before them the terrible consequences of self-willed in two of their number, two ordinary members, as we would say, and not merely a privileged Levite. In a word then, whether the attention was called to the divine actings without or within, abroad or at home, it was all for the purpose, now get this please, of impressing their hearts and minds with a deep sense of the moral importance of obedience. Let me read that again. It was all for the purpose of impressing the hearts and minds with a deep sense of the moral importance of obedience. This was the one grand aim of all the rehearsals, all the comments, all the exhortations of the faithful servant of God who was so soon to be removed from their midst. So here we see, excellent, to me, devotional read, simple, to the point, but to me, kind of lofty in many respects, as McIntosh tries to bring out the thrust of these particular words. So going back to Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 20 to 22, the motivation to fear God was couched within the goodness of God on behalf of the people. What were they supposed to do? Fear, serve, cleave, and swear to him, or swear by him. Now look at chapter 11, drop down to verses 7 to verse 9. Let's read this again. But your eyes have seen all the great acts of the Lord which he did. Therefore, since you saw and heard, and it's supposed to leave an indelible impression in your hearts and minds as if written or engraved with a hammer or a chisel, therefore shall ye keep all the commandments which I command you this day, that ye may be strong, go in, possess the land, whether ye go to possess it, and that ye may what? Prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers to give unto them and to their seed, a land that floweth with milk and honey. How clear, how simple, how precise can that be? And again, nothing touching salvation. No one, whether after Adam, before Noah, before and after the flood, before or after the call of Abraham, before or after the building of the temple, before or after the coming of the prophets, and even up until, even up to this present time, beloved, even after the events of the cross, the tomb, the empty tomb, the resurrection and the ascension, no one has ever been saved. No one has ever been justified by simply doing works righteousness. No one is saved by the keeping of the law. However, Israel's keeping, look at verse 1 of chapter 11, Israel's keeping of the charge of their God, the statutes of their God, the judgments of their God, and the commandments of their God would guarantee verse 9. And we're talking about something earthly, tangible, physical, carnal. And by carnal, I'm simply meaning something of substance, nothing in the evil sense, nothing lewd. Verses 9 is as clear as the nose on your head. He tells them, your eyes have seen the great acts of the Lord, therefore keep his charge, keep his commandments, be strong, go in, take the land, and thus your lives will be prolonged. Now look at verses 10 to 12. For the land whither thou goest in to possess it is not as the land of Egypt. So apparently there's no comparison from when she came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest it with thy foot as a garden of herbs. Okay? But this land, which I'm about to give you, whether ye go to possess it, is a land of hills and valleys, drinketh water of the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. He calls it a land which the Lord cares for. Again, we see a people who had so much light, so much knowledge, and so many reasons, so many motivators to fear, serve, cleave, and to swear. But as their record would eventually show in time, they failed. They failed. And I don't say that in any kind of a gloating manner, but in the sense of being, I'm pretty confident God was greatly, greatly disappointed with that nation. And I'm pretty confident that there was no great delight on his part in bringing the negative consequences that he promised would eventually fall if they did not keep and serve and fear and cleave. Now drop down to verse 13 to verse 17. It shall come to pass if ye shall hearken diligently. Again, notice this is a conditional covenantal responsibility. If ye shall hearken diligently unto my commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God, to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. There it is, that I will give you. Notice, I will give you the rain of your land in due season, the first rain and the latter rain, that thou mayest gather in thy corn and thy wine and thy oil. Notice, nothing at all about getting to heaven. Nothing at all about going to heaven. Nothing about sins being forgiven. Nothing about a new name written down in glory. We're talking about Israel's Palestinian covenant, their remaining in the land, the prosperity of the land, the blessing of the Lord upon them. They would be the head and not the tail. Was all contingent on their obedience. God did not give them an open checkbook to simply rebel against him, and God would just simply smile from heaven and shower down the blessings. Many people, I think, today, especially our futurist brethren, have a hard time making a distinction between a conditional covenant and an unconditional covenant. Turn to Genesis chapter 12. Let's look at the Abrahamic covenant as it was first given to Father Abraham, and then it would be further expanded throughout his life. Now let's look at the initial covenant that was given. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy kindred and from thy kindred. Let me go back. Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land which I shall show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation. Now there's no condition. This here is an unconditional covenantal blessing being given to Father Abraham. Notice who's responsible for bringing this covenant about. God. I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in all the families of, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now the very verbiage here, there's no conditions attached to here. Okay? It's not contingent upon Abraham's responses, good or bad, towards God. God says, this is what's going to happen, and my name's on the line, my glory, my honor, my very being and nature is on the line. I'm going to bring this about. And nothing's going to stop me. But when you come so far, going back to Deuteronomy chapter 11, you don't find that found here. You find God telling, do this and be blessed, right? Obey and be blessed. Keep and be blessed. If you don't take heed, the blessings stop. And you will be destroyed from off the very land that you prize so much. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 28. I'm amazed on how many people today just jumble this up and they just don't get it right. Look at Deuteronomy 28, verse 1. And it shall come to pass, circle, underline, asterisk, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth. Beloved, this is conditional. I'm sorry. You can twist the Bible all you want. You can come with your presuppositions and your preconceived notions and make it say something that it doesn't say. And all these blessings shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Underline, asterisk, whatever. If thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. And all the way down to verses what? 15? Yes. No, excuse me. Verses 14. Are all of the blessings, everything that God would shower upon them, physically, naturally, earthly, carnally, between him and them as a nation on that parcel of land that they were going to conquer. But then notice verses 15. But it shall come to pass, circle, underline, asterisk, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe, to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day. In verse 15, you find the same things mentioned in chapter what? 11. Statutes, charge, commandments, whatever. All these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. And beloved, the rest of this chapter is nothing, all the way down to what? Verses 68 is nothing but an awful warning of the hammer of the Almighty. If the people were so foolish, to poke God in the eye, so to speak. And then notice verses 18, going back to Deuteronomy 11, verse 18. Therefore shall ye lay up these words, underline, in your heart and in your soul. Bind them upon as a sign upon the hand, that thou mayest, and that they may be as frontlets between your eyes. And then in verses 19, the fact that you were to teach these things to their children diligently from sun up to sun down. They were even to write them on the very doorpost of their very houses. Why? Verse 21, that your days may be multiplied in the land that the Lord swore unto your fathers to give it as the days of heaven upon earth. Look at Deuteronomy 6. True religion has always been something that was cultivated in the heart, not external ritual and ceremony. Deuteronomy 6:6, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. Look at Psalm 119 as I kind of wrap this up. Psalm 119. What is true religion? What is a true walk between you and your God? Is it found in ceremony? Is it found in ritual? Is it found in bells, witness, bells and whistles, incense, smoke, and beads, and crucifixes, and whatever? Psalm 119, verse 11, what does Scripture say? Thy word have I hid in my heart, that I might not sin against thee. Notice, true religion is in the heart. Colossians 3:16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And then finally, what did Jesus say to the woman there at the well? John 4:24. What did Jesus tell her? She was pointing to one mountain. The Israelites would point to another mountain, okay, as a place to worship, as if some tangible geographical spot on the earth was really paramount. Verse 24, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit, in the heart, and in truth. And so, my dear friends, Israel had already become, as far as population, as the stars of heaven in the days of Moses. So that portion of the unconditional portion of Abraham's covenant in that respect was fulfilled. However, their continuance in the land would be predicated upon one thing, their obedience from the heart, taking heed to what Moses is giving to them there in that chapter 11, to take heed, to do it, and then to pass it on to the next generation from morning until night. When you walk, stand, sit, crawl, whatever, they were to instill these precepts into the very hearts and minds of their children. And unfortunately, history bears it out. They failed. And they failed all the more so when the Word of God came to them, stood before them, and they cried out to what? We have no king but Caesar. And that was the final nail to their national apostasy when they crucified Christ and claimed that the emperor in Rome was their true king. Well, may God choose to bless his word this morning.